Welcome to It's About Florida, a weekly discussion program tackling the key issues and topics of interest to our state. I'm Lynn Hatter. 2 years after the massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, scientists are still trying to piece together what happened to the thousands of gallons of crude oil that kept gushing into the ocean. Recently, many of those scientists gathered in Tallahassee to discuss their long-term study of the effects of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. We've gathered them all into our studio for an update with our host, Tramell Gomes.
Welcome to It's About Florida. It's our weekly discussion program tackling key issues of interest to our state. What is the Deep Sea Consortium? I stumbled upon you guys. So what are you guys all about? Why are you guys gathering in Tallahassee? And what's your purpose?
Yeah, after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in April of 2010, it was obvious that one of the major gaps in science was what we knew about the Gulf of Mexico to begin with. It was a relatively understudied region. And then when the oil spill hit and people wanted to know, how bad is this? How does the oil move around the Gulf? What happened to it? And what are the ecological consequences? How's it going to affect the fish I eat, for instance? So that's largely what this consortium and seven other consortia around the Gulf are. They're trying to answer those sorts of questions that are important to the citizens of the country.
And Dr. Felicia Coleman, tell me about your background and back to how this consortium got put together.
Well, my background actually is in the ecology of fishes. I'm particularly interested in fish behavior, how fish interact with habitat, and I'm also interested in how science is incorporated into policy. So that's my interest in what I've spent most of my career working on. As far as the deep sea, how did it get put together? Well, it's several of us sat down and started talking about it and looking around and trying to figure out. We knew who our colleagues were across the country, what was the best, strongest team that we could put together and integrate that team. So while people sitting at this table have talked about the different things they work on chemistry, on oceanographics, on the flow in the ocean and things like that, we wanted to make sure that we had a team that could tackle a set of questions together.
All right. And we have a packed room here today. A lot of you guys, so glad that you were able to take time out of your schedule to join me here on the program. So Let's get into what you guys are actually doing here. Who can tell me their expertise? Let's go to you.
So I'm Chris Reddy. I'm again from Woods Hole, and I study oil spills and studied many of them before Deepwater Horizon. And I'm particularly interested in what happens to all these organic compounds that get released from oil. So they all have different personalities. They all have different toxicities. They all get eaten by bacteria differently. And that's the big crossword puzzle I study.
And what is happening to all the
It's an incredibly dynamic activity. Some compounds got evaporated very quickly. Some got eaten by bacteria within days, and there are other compounds that continue to persist on the beach. And right now we're trying to put all those pieces together.
What do we know now?
Well, we don't see it, but that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have any impact. And we know that a lot of things changed. We know that some oil went one place, some oil went another place, which is that itself is interesting.
That is the most fascinating thing following the oil spill. Like, where did all this oil that we saw for these many days continuing to gush into the ocean? Where did it all go?
Well, it depends on its personality. It's just like if you gave 100 kids $100 at a mall, they would all do just different things with their money. That's the same thing with oil compounds. They all want to go different places depending on what they want. Some never made it to the surface. Some made it in these subsurface plumes. Some made it to the surface and were slicks that eventually got burnt. Some made it to the surface and eventually got burnt by in situ burning. And so this is a very dynamic and exciting puzzle. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be careful when you generalize about oil, because it's really a bunch of personalities.
Oh, wow. And this is what you guys are all doing. And what's your role in this? Tell me about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, so my name is Bob Weisberg, and I'm a professor of physical oceanography, which means the ocean circulation, how the water moves around. And so if there is a spill of any substance into the ocean, the concern is, where is it going to go? Well, it gets carried by the ocean currents. And so if we're going to predict where a landfall might be on a beach, or whether or not oil is going to just stay offshore or go to a certain region, we need to know what the ocean circulation is. So my role has really been to try to describe and predict where the water moves to.
Yeah. I remember watching and with going out with all the public officials from the governor and everyone staging heading to Pensacola to see, and just watching that first instance of when it was washed up on shore and on Pensacola Beach and seeing that white sand and the contrast to this gooey, chocolatey. It looked really good to touch, but once you touched it, it was like, oh, greasy, and it was stuck on your hand. So the consistency was weird. Tell me about yourself and your role and the impact on that, seeing that oil come ashore.
Yeah, I'm Marcus Huddle, and I'm working at the Earth Ocean Atmospheric Science Department at FSU. Well, I'm a coastal oceanographer and typically working on the shallow environments here on our beautiful coast in Florida, and I enjoy that very much, going to these beaches and seeing this wonderful water. And believe me, when I went out to Pensacola in May, end of May, I was absolutely shocked. I saw water that was having colors, carrying colors that I'd never seen before, like orange and brown tones. The water was milky and foamy. The foam was not white, as you know it. The foam was brown. Every single wave that retreated from the beach left a brown mark in the sand.
So what impact does this have on our fish life and the sea life and all of our seafood that we need to be concerned with? Like, you know, we're seeing the state and the campaign and all the BP commercials saying that everything that's plastered over, that's saying, come on back, everything is good, you can Gulf seafood safe. Is that the case? Tell me your name and what you do.
So again, I'm Dean Grubbs, and I'm primarily a fish ecologist with FSU. And so I study the biology, life history, and ecology of a wide array of fishes. So within this consortium, if you think of the food web of the Gulf of Mexico, I'm at the top of that pyramid. I study mostly the larger fishes, so a lot of the sharks and the big bony fishes and things like that. Well, as far as this oil spill goes, one of the problems we had is that the oil spill occurred nearly a mile deep in the deep sea, and we actually don't know that much about the biology of the deep sea. Most of what we know about is in the upper 100 feet, you know, the shallower parts of the Gulf of Mexico on the shelf. We don't really know that much about the community structure, so my part of this consortium was really to start looking at the community structure of the fish there to first determine, well, what is there? And then once we determine what's there, then we could start looking at whether the oil is getting into the fish. In other words, are they actually eating things that have eaten things that contained oil? And so are they metabolizing the oils?
What did you find?
So far what we found is that, for one thing, it's just an incredible array of just wild and wonderful fishes that are down there. We catch fishes that range from a snail fish that looks like a little snot blob that is, 3 inches long and it's an adult and it's living 10,000 feet deep, something that most people have never seen before. And then right alongside it, we may catch a blunt-nosed six-gill shark that's 17 feet long and the largest predator in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's an incredible array. And we're also finding that a lot of these species are undocumented, or mm-hmm. or exactly which species it is unclear. Their taxonomies are unsure. Okay.
Does this mean you get a chance to find a species and have it named after yourself?
There are rules to that. Unfortunately, you can't just name it after yourself. You can potentially name it after someone else. But we have found what we believe are some new species. It'll take a while. Taxonomy is a slow process, so it takes several years before we get to the point of actually making sure and naming them.
Yeah. So we've heard, I've seen some reports of, like, you know, following and maybe people unsure, like shrimp missing eyes and certain seafood with lesions and all that stuff. What do you make of that, and what does the evidence actually show?
Well, the evidence seems to be pretty diverse. Pretty varied from place to place. I've seen some of the same reports, and most of the work we're doing is deeper than say 300 feet deep, but it does include some species that are in the as part of our human food chain, part of what we eat, things like tilefish and snapper, and so far we haven't seen much in terms of those types of lesions. Other people have reported lesions. We have looked at, with colleagues at the University of North Florida, we've been looking at looking at biomarkers to see if they're actually metabolizing the oil. And there is some evidence that there's oil metabolism going on, so it is getting into the food chain. But separating out whether it's specifically to the oil spill or part of natural oil, and that's another question. And one thing I will say is that so far for the deep water fishes that we've looked at, even those that are showing elevated levels of metabolizing the oil, it's still relatively low levels. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing anything that's off the chart that would make us, at this point at least, worry about eating these fish. But one other point is that the deeper you go in the ocean, the slower things live, the slower their lives are, the slower their metabolism is. And so it'll take some time before we actually may be able to see the overall effects of the oil spill.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We've been speaking with scientists studying the effects of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Now we get back to our conversation with our host, Tramell Gomes.
Yeah, I wanted to be clear on that. You said we shouldn't be concerned towards the end there. I understand Mr. Reddy was saying that you don't want to scare the public too much, but should we be concerned, and how concerned should we be about the oil that's getting into the food chain? Dr. Coleman.
One place to look to get information about that, and this has nothing to do with the oil spill, but every state – actually, the state of Florida just came out with their advisory list. We put it on our website, and the concern there is mercury, because mercury is a neurotoxin. It's extremely dangerous for you don't want pregnant women and small children eating fish that are contaminated with mercury. And so there are a number of species that there actually are problems associated with mercury. Now, one of the issues that we're working on as part of the consortium is, did the oil spill create an environment that would cause mercury to be changed into a form, methylated, that is the type of mercury that accumulates in predators, and it accumulates and becomes a health hazard for people. Mm-hmm. So it's potentially an indirect effect of the oil, but we haven't made that link yet. And I agree with Dr. Reddy's statement that this is a long-term study.
How long?
Well, right now we'll be looking at it for 3 years, and we hope to be looking at it over the next decade. Yeah. And it does take time for things to accumulate in those species and in the system. So, I mean, if you ask me if I eat the fish, I eat them. I don't have a problem with it at all. Yeah. But one other thing I would like to mention, you know, one of the questions that comes up repeatedly is this the worst thing that ever happened to the Gulf of Mexico?
And is it?
No, I don't think it is. You know, it was a point that I've often tried to make, and that is if you sort of look back at the history, the Gulf of Mexico has been something of the redheaded stepchild. You know, it doesn't get the money or attention from the government in terms of funding. I mean, it's just that's the truth. It's part of it contains many of the poorest states in the nation.
What kind of funding would it need?
Don't ask a scientist.
Like to do what actually? Like, how to help the Gulf?
Yeah, we're far behind the eight ball already from not getting baseline information before something, an event like this happened. But this isn't the only event. We've got, you know, an agricultural problem in the breadbasket of America, dumping all this, you know, agricultural waste into the Gulf of Mexico that creates hypoxic zones that kills, you know, it drives oxygen out of the water. So you're losing an enormous amount of animals that are important to us economically. We've lost hundreds of thousands of acres of wetlands due to development, including oil and gas development. You know, so in some places, if we think that we're having problems from sea level rise, we're having problems with the land just sinking because of loss of sediment. This is an important problem off the coast of Louisiana. New Orleans is sinking.
Yeah.
And if you so one of the things that came up recently is the Restore Act. There's a tremendous interest in doing restoration in the Gulf of Mexico. But is that restoration that's going to repair the damage of the spill? Or is that restoration that's going to potentially help repair the resiliency and the health of the entire marine ecosystem?
You tell me, what do we know about the Restore Act and how is it being used and how should it be used to really make an impact?
Again, don't act as scientists.
Let's go, Mr. Weisberg. How should the Restore Act and those kind of aid be used?
So as it turned out in last December, I was asked to go testify before a House committee on the Restore Act, and I tried to point out certain deficiencies in it. And so you can think about two things. One is restoring the livelihood of people that were hurt, whose livelihood was hurt. And the other aspect is restoring the Gulf of Mexico in some less than well-defined way. So the way I looked at it is every kid knows when they get an automobile and they want to learn how to fix their car that if you don't know how it works, you can't fix it. The Gulf of Mexico is kind of like a car. It's a very complicated system. If we want to understand the fisheries, we have to understand how the whole system works. And so my hope is that the Restore Act in restoring the Gulf of Mexico would provide sufficient funding over a long enough period of time so that we can actually attack the Gulf of Mexico as a complex system, learn how it works, so that not only could we deal with the oil spill going forward, but also deal more intelligently with overfishing, with harmful algae, red tide blooms, any application that humans may have in the coastal zone.
So you gave your advice and along those lines, and was it taken and incorporated into
what? The Restore Act passed. The distribution or apportionment of funds was passed more or less as it was presented. My argument was that we needed a lot more money, a larger proportion of that money actually going into the science of understanding how the Gulf of Mexico as a complex system works.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that we achieved enough of an apportionment of funds to actually do that. Now, the Restore Act has not been implemented yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is opportunity still to make small modifications so that, in fact, how these monies will eventually be used will be as beneficial to society as we can make it.
Yeah, we were just recently covering how a coalition of counties here in Florida are trying to get together to figure out how to portion out the funds that are coming down. What about the funding from BP themselves? And is the deep sea being funded by BP as part of what you guys do, funded by BP? And how does that work out? And what about – I'm going to throw all this in this into this question, making sure that what you guys are doing is unbiased.
So I'm Eric Chassinier, director of the Deep Sea Consortium, and this consortium is funded by GOMRI, which is the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiatives. What they have at their disposal is $500 million that was provided by BP with no strings attached. So what they have done is provide several requests for proposal, some that were quickly after the oil spill in order to involve scientists into evaluating the impact of the spill on the Gulf. And then afterward, a more elaborated request for several consortia to propose what they thought would be best to provide interdisciplinary and interinstitution research. So it's led by a research board of very well-known, recognized scientists, and the proposal were scientifically evaluated. There was, I can affirm, because given the way not only the way the consortia were distributed, but who received the funds, that there was no politics involved in the selection of this proposal. So we have now been working together for a little less than a year. We have 100 scientists that are here for 2 days in Tallahassee to discuss our progress and everything. And there is absolutely no input whatsoever or any directions provided either by the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative or by BP. We are doing the science that we think is best.
A real-world science project, as you mentioned earlier, that your research has changed and all of that stuff. About the oil spill, and we've seen Florida tease the idea of, like, you know, continued drilling or opening Florida's shores to offshore drilling. Is this practice too dangerous to move forward? Any thoughts on drilling from your standpoint?
I would just like to say for one of the reasons. Yes, I'm Chris Reddy. One of the things you want to think about from Deepwater Horizon is always whenever you have an accident to think about a silver lining. For essentially, we don't have an opportunity to study the Gulf of Mexico that often on a scale like this. We can't put it on a treadmill, and the Gulf of Mexico can't be MRI'd. And so when we spike it with a tracer, just like they do in medical studies, we can learn a lot about it. And so what hopefully, to answer a lot of your questions, is what we learn from this treadmill, this medical test in many respects, we can help make more well-informed decisions about the questions you just asked about Florida and protect, perhaps identify areas where maybe we don't want to go near because they don't recover as fast, for example. So maybe you don't build a drilling rig near someplace due to the currents. We'll drive it onto the coast that fast. So that's the knowledge learned from this spill will help us. That's the silver lining.
Is that being heard by the scientific community? Like, you know, maybe you can't go and drill in this certain area if it's not outright stop drilling. Like, maybe don't go in this area to drill, go over there or something like that. Are your voices being heard in that respect, Mr. Weisberg?
No, I think the answer is yes. I think the most important thing we can do is to continue as scientists in an objective manner as possible, because it makes no sense to simply say, well, we shouldn't drill in the Gulf of Mexico. We need energy. And so the more we understand how these natural systems function, the better our predictive capabilities become, and the better we can comment in an objective way on what might be perceived as best practice. And I think that's our job as scientists. I don't think our job is to raise our voice and say, well, we shouldn't do this or shouldn't do that.
What does it say to the – I don't know if I'm going too far here – the Earth's ability to repair itself in situations like this? Am I going too far?
No, I don't think you're going too far. I would say the Gulf of Mexico is a fairly robust, resilient system, remarkably so. You know, you don't want to push it to the point where it just, you know, meets some tipping point and it completely changes. All right. So that's one of the things that you absolutely don't want to happen. But I think there were a couple of things that were very different about this bill and the way that it was handled. One thing is the putting dispersants on the oil at depth. It made that oil unavailable to come to the surface and be that could be changed or gone to beaches and being eaten by microbes, by bacteria, mm-hmm. oil-eating bacteria. It's just really cool stuff. Anyway, but the other thing is it's deposition in a very deep environment that, I mean, this is, you talk about the slow world. That is the slow world in the deep sea. Things grow slowly. They live for extremely long periods of time. I mean, there are worms down there that are, you know, 100 years old and more. And Dean could say some things about some of the fish down there as well. Yeah, it's like remarkable.
Like you said earlier. So it was, seeing that was the one aspect of that torturous, those days of watching the spill and wondering when it's going to be closed up and getting an actual glimpse of that deep sea ocean and through the cameras and all of that stuff. Any final thoughts as we wrap up here about what you guys are doing, what you guys are finding out about deep sea life, and what's next in this process to learn about the impact and the lasting effects of this spill, this historical spill?
As Chris alluded earlier, this oil spill can also be seen from a scientific point of view as an enormous experiment. There was a fantastic injection of organic matter into the system, which is typically low in organic matter. If you go to the middle of the Gulf, the water is crystal clear and visibility is hundreds of meters in some areas. So if you inject an enormous amount of organic matter, it's like if you have a fish tank at home and you try to feed your fish and the lid is not close, right? And shoop, oops, my God. I have all this organic matter now in my fish tank. So what will you observe if you don't take it out immediately? And we couldn't do that. Yeah. So you will see that this organic matter causes a chain reaction because, of course, it's immediately attacked by bacteria that consume oxygen, that produce other products that now interfere with the whole food chain in this aquarium and with the whole with the biogeochemical processes, with the large organism that you can see, but also with the minerals that are in there. For instance, metals can go into dissolution and so forth, and all that has consequences that we don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. So what we will now observe is that we had this very big injection of organic matter. Some of that is toxic. Some of that can readily be degraded, and that will have consequences that can reach far in the future. That is something that we don't really understand and know yet. And so this deep sea project gives us the opportunity to really, with a good foundation, to look into the future and to make very, very profound investigation that help us.
And your name again?
Marcus Hutel.
Marcus Hutel, thank you so much. And thanks to each and every one of you for taking time out of your schedule to join me here on It's About Florida. From your Deep Sea Consortium. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to the scientists of the Deep Sea Consortium. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. Our host is Tramell Gomes, with technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. Please join us again next week for more discussions on the issues impacting our state.